We have Ian with us on the line. Hello, Ian.
Hello. How are you doing, Doug? Thank you very much for having me this evening.
Well, thank you, Ian, and thanks for your joining us. And, Ian, you know, I thought maybe we could begin with some of the background to the case. And and first of all, dealing with yourself, you know, you're a Hamiltonian. You were raised here.
Could you
give us a little bit of your background about growing up in Hamilton and your education and so on?
Okay. A native Hamiltonian, born and raised. Basically, I grew up in the East End on Balsam Avenue, which is right beside Iverwind Stadium, or the former Iverwind Stadium. Went to Prince of Wales, grew up in that part of the city. Later, we moved. So I went to high school primarily at Westdale. And studied on a scholarship, went to the University of Toronto, was at Trinity College for 4 years, and received another scholarship to complete graduate studies in the UK, after which I traveled and worked in the Middle East for approximately 17 years prior to our evacuation from my last workplace in Syria, in Damascus, as a contract worker for the U.S. Embassy there. And so we were forced to relocate once again back to Hamilton, to my hometown, where I thought we could quite frankly find refuge from the conflict and the turmoil in the region over there. Unfortunately, things didn't work out as planned.
Yeah, which is, you know, really surprising and terrible. Now you and Wafa have been married for quite some time.
Yes, we've been married for approximately 12 years.
Yeah, and you have three children?
We have three children. Our eldest, Zainab, is 11 years old. We have a son, Yusuf, who's 9, and our youngest, Fatima, is 6 years old. So we've been married for quite some time, and I don't think there was any question of the validity of the marriage at all. At least it was never raised as an issue, and I assume that it was never one, even in the eyes of the powers that be. So we're really baffled by the entire process. From the get-go, we encountered obstacles when we came back, and it's very disappointing to see the end result. But as they say, it's not over until the fat lady sings, and we're working very hard right now. We're looking towards the future and for my wife's return to her family here in Canada, and so we're going to be beginning that process fairly soon.
And you know, when the insurrection began in Syria and became an extremely dangerous place, how did you go about getting yourselves out of Syria and back home?
Well, it was an extremely tricky situation, so much so, as you can imagine, that up until the time when we were actually on the plane and it was lifting off the runway for our first connection to Rome Airport, I honestly believe that we wouldn't get out. And I had serious doubts about that. And basically, the situation, it spiraled out of control very quickly. Very few people anticipated how quickly things would essentially spiral out of control. And so for the last period, even while I was still working and on schedule, I was actually driving through firefights in certain neighborhoods in order to get to my workplace. Eventually, the situation got to the point where the U.S. Embassy issued a formal evacuation for those who wished to leave, essentially non-essential personnel connected with the embassy there and with the Department of Cultural Affairs. And so that meant us. And I went to the Canadian Embassy and applied for a visitor's visa for my wife to come back to Canada. And the procedure took longer than expected, but thankfully she was issued the visa. And so she came in on a valid visa as a visitor to the country. And we came back and, you know, we really didn't know what we were going to do at that point. And so we considered our options, and the situation didn't seem to be letting up over there. So I decided that I was going to file a sponsorship application for my wife of 12 years as a Canadian citizen with three Canadian children. I didn't anticipate any problems. In most countries that I've ever been to, it's simply a matter of course that a citizen of that country could very easily file a sponsorship application for his or her spouse. And so I was very surprised when I went down to the CIC office here in Hamilton and was told, not simply by one person who gave me so-called conflicting information or incorrect information, but I was actually told initially by the person with whom I spoke, and then later in the course of a meeting, which essentially amounted to a multi-person consultative process. I mean, there were different people consulting with each other in that second meeting, and I was told unequivocally that I did not meet the financial qualifications to sponsor my wife. And as it turned out later, the information was false in the sense that there is no minimum wage requirement as such, but the area is left deliberately vague. In any case, I was told in a very systematic fashion, point by point, by one individual that I would have to be making X amount of money in order for them to consider allowing me to file the sponsorship application. And, you know, it was a ridiculous figure, which he claimed that I would have to be earning in order to financially support my wife and three Canadian dependent children as well. It was a figure which, quite frankly, is much higher than most of the Canadians married to their Canadian wives who have three or more children and are working here in Hamilton at the present time. So I was quite surprised, but I didn't have any reason at that point to doubt what he was saying. After all, this was the official Canadian government office, and I went in there in good faith, and I accepted the information I was given in the same light. And as it turned out, my wife was filed that day as a refugee claimant and was put on a fast-tracking process to what amounted to, in the end, an expedited deportation process. And so essentially, that very same day, as we found out later, she was flagged by a government body fairly newly created under Kenney's administration, known as the Backlog Reduction Office, as ominous as that sounds.
Oh, my.
But they flagged her that same afternoon for an expedited deportation process, which boggles the mind of just about any lawyer I've spoken to about this, because how can they flag somebody for an expedited process before that person has ever been given a hearing?
Oh, exactly. That sounds just unbelievable.
It's preemptive, and, you know, it makes absolutely no sense.
No, and you're applying expecting that you'll receive some fair assessment of the application.
But what I found out in the course of this whole process, and, of course, the nightmare began when they actually processed her as a refugee, because from that point onward, it was just a long series of interrogations, check-ins, harassment, to the point where I actually had officials from the office sometimes visiting us at one point, very early in the morning, coming to our house unannounced, visiting my mother unannounced, demanding information that they quite frankly were not privy to. So we were essentially treated as criminals. The assumption is made in the course of these refugee proceedings that everybody who is a refugee claimant is up to no good, and there's an automatic assumption that they're trying to cheat the system, and so the system, they basically have to prove themselves innocent. It's basically a guilty until proven innocent type process. And, it so many things bordered on the absurd. On one case in the course of a so-called hearing, and these are kangaroo courts, as any legal expert will tell you, any specialist in immigration at the current time will tell you, it's basically a top-down decision-making process whereby you go to a hearing with your lawyer, with legal counsel. The decisions have already been made. There is no hearing as such, in the sense that you can't change whatever decision has already been pre-decided by a tribunal. And so the judge is basically a puppet, is basically a figurehead who is essentially there, and they're not real judges. Our first judge in our first hearing was actually a qualified figure skating instructor. And you know, basically in this hearing, just to give you an idea of how absurd these proceedings are, at one point I mentioned the continued instability in Syria, and they demanded proof that Syria was unstable. And of course I smiled and I said, well, I mean, everybody knows, it's in the media, it's on the news, there's a civil war. Do you have proof that there's a civil war? That's not proof.
When you're
confronted with that kind of absurdity, what can you say? Basically, we went through this, and, you know, people that my wife knew socially in the Muslim community, at times being approached, even in the mosques, and questioned about my wife, asked to try to obtain private information, if they could, about my wife and my family. And so that kind of rigorous investigative process is really something I would expect in a police state. It's not something that I ever expected here. And I'm not saying that abuse of the system doesn't take place, but the people they're targeting here with this system, these are the soft targets, Doug. These are people like my wife who are following due process, who are going to the check-ins, who are diligently filing the paperwork when asked to do so, people that they can basically target because they're there to target. They're not doing anything to put a dent in the hard cases that they claim they're trying to eliminate, because these aren't people who follow the process to begin with. And so it's one of those situations where, you know, as in the case of my wife, she was basically incarcerated with a bunch of mothers and housewives, many of whom had been here and had been paying taxes and working and contributing to the system and to Canada for many, many years, and many cases far worse than my wife's case. And, of course, there's more to it than that. So many other things that happened while she was in detention. I mean, being stripped down, having her headscarf removed.
Ian, maybe we could just step back a minute then. Yeah. So when was she put in detention? And why?
January 14th, we went to what we thought would be yet another routine check-in. And so we went to Airport Road, and we went out there. That was in Mississauga. And we went to the check-in, and we sensed immediately that something was wrong. They weren't following the regular routine. The man who came in obviously seemed to be a rough type. He didn't really seem to know what was going on as it pertained to my wife's case. He stated at the outset that our regular caseworker would not be there and that he was taking over. And so he came in and immediately began to inform my wife that she was going to be deported as soon as possible. And so we called the lawyer, and we were consulting with the lawyer over the phone while this was taking place. He became angry and agitated. At one point, he did consult somebody else who came and said that the decisions had already been made and this gentleman had to follow through. So he came back to the window. And at one point, they didn't like the fact that I was in touch with the lawyer. And so he became angry and he sort of shouted at me and said, you know, we don't have to listen to lawyers. We can throw lawyers out of here if we want to. And then he demanded to isolate my wife and not allow her personal access to me, because I was beside her as her interpreter, or to the lawyer indirectly who was on the phone with me at the time. And so they tried to do that, and while they had her in isolation, they were telling her she had no right to be in this country, she didn't belong here, she had no future here, and if she didn't answer the questions that they were asking, that, you know, they would press charges, she would have a criminal record, she'd never get Medicare, they'd take her children away, they'd put them in foster care. And my wife was baffled because she's wondering where all of this is coming from. She's never broken any laws, she's never done anything wrong. And at that point, three men came with guns, and they were armed. They didn't draw the guns, but one of them did put his hand on the gun, and he said, don't make me use force if I have to, we're arresting you. And so they basically took my wife away, and, of course, I was in a panic. I was on the phone with the lawyer. And then we found out that my wife had been relocated to to Rexdale, to the detention center there, where she remained for well over 100 days before they finally deported her. And, you know, we tried everything within our power to prevent them from doing so. We made direct appeals. David Christofferson, who thankfully intervened at the opportune moment to avert her initially scheduled deportation date, which was on the 15th of February. So she would have been out very quickly had he not intervened. And he pointed out that they had not done their due diligence in processing the minimal amount of paperwork that they had to do. And so they weren't even following their own due process at this point. That's how expedited the process was in my wife's case. They refused to give any reason why they seemed to be so fixated on deporting her, per se. But he pressured them. He issued a personal appeal to Mr. Kenny, and was surprised, I won't say surprised, but we discovered that her file was actually with Mr. Taves, the Minister of Public Safety. And so then we started to issue the appeals to him, and then I guess he passed it back and forth to Kenny. And, I mean, the PMO's office was contacted. So it's not possible for people to say in the very upper levels of power that they had no knowledge of my wife's situation. Everybody was well informed, and we were keeping them well informed. There was so much public support. There was a petition that was being sent directly to Mr. Kenny's office, as well as several letters that were being sent to the three offices, Mr. Kenny's, Mr. Taves, and Mr. Harper's office. And unfortunately, none of that pressure seemed to alter the decision that had been made to deport my wife. And at one point, my wife was told unequivocally in her last tribunal before the judge that the decision had been made by the minister personally, who deemed my wife's situation to be as it had been decided previously, and that his decision was to deport my wife because he felt that that was in the best interest of immigration. So, I mean, that was his decision. So,
It seems incredible to me that statement by the minister, and given that WAFA has no criminal record, no record of any wrongdoing whatsoever, to be denied in this way,
now that you've mentioned that, and I was hesitating there. But I'll quote exactly what my wife was told at the tribunal, that the minister had reviewed the situation and deemed it in the national interest to proceed with my wife's deportation as it had been initially scheduled. Now, what does that mean? It's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling.
That phrase is almost Nixonian in my mind, yes.
Yeah, it is almost Nixonian, but the entire process was Nixonian. Mm. One of the things that my wife was told, and I should mention that when my wife was in detention, in addition to being stripped down and photographed in cubicles and this, that, and the other thing, she was on occasion interrogated by people who would come into the detention center who refused to identify themselves and were clearly not immigration officials. They were, for the most part, white Canadians who would come in, speak to her in fluent Arabic, and try to ask her questions about her religious beliefs, about any kind of group affiliations that she may or may not have, questions about me, questions about people that she may or may not know abroad in the Middle East. And my wife, of course, refused to answer any of these questions. But at one point, very ominously so, a gentleman claimed that perhaps she would be more cooperative answering the same types of questions in Egyptian police custody, which caused us some concern because this was less than a week before she was scheduled to be deported.
Oh, my.
And, you know, we were rather concerned about that. This same gentleman refusing to introduce himself by name to my wife also called me on the phone, and it was a very disturbing telephone conversation, asking for information, wanting to know specific information about what my legal strategy might be within the next few days. And of course, I refused to discuss that. I recommended he discuss it with my lawyer personally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was asking me some other questions, again, refusing to identify who exactly he was. And, also very strange, but almost Nixonian. One of the things that she was being told by these people was that because, and get this one, because I had chosen to live abroad for so many years, I had essentially waived my full rights to Canadian citizenship, which, as far as I'm concerned, is ridiculous because I'm unaware of any legislation that's been passed that states that a Canadian who resides abroad for an extended period of time in any way waives or lessens his full rights as a Canadian citizen in his own country. So where they're coming up with that kind of information is beyond me. It sounds like wishful thinking on the part of these, you know, strange figures who go around doing whatever it is they do. But Nixonian, I think, is a fairly accurate term to describe you know, some of the things that were said.
Yeah, and I think all Canadians should be deeply disturbed by this process, lack of fairness and openness and lack of transparency. You and WAFA have been deprived of all your rights on this.
Well, you know, the United Nations has repeatedly stressed that the inherent rights of children is to not be deprived of either of their parents. And, you know, Canada is a signatory on recent legislation and documentation issued via the United Nations stating that. And, it's mind-boggling that this government would decide to deport a mother of three Canadian children, and the youngest being only 6 years old, knowing full well that this would deprive these children of their rights to have the presence of both parents. And for a government that speaks so often and stresses so often the notion of family values, it really flies in the face of that. It's very hypocritical. But as somebody mentioned to me, well, no, they mean what they say about family values. They just don't mean your family. you know, what am I supposed to say?
Yeah.
The elephant in the room, of course, has always been the fact that my wife is a fairly conservative Muslim woman. And I mean, in all that entails, she's covered, and, you know, she obviously has an Islamic trend in terms of her physical appearance. And, you know, I've known so many people, Doug, who have come into this country who have gone to CIC. I've even known people who've been unemployed, and some of whom I've been told about who have been collecting, you know, government assistance. And they've gone in with their wives from, I know of two cases, one who had a wife from California and the other a wife from New Zealand, and they were both told, I don't worry about it. And the papers were basically pushed through, and it wasn't an issue. And yet I've known other cases of women who have been from, well, surprisingly enough, places like Pakistan, Egypt, Iraq, who, for whatever reason, have had the book thrown at them and have had every single detail gone through with a fine-tooth comb.
And
so what is one supposed to assume?
Yeah, and I thought we had freedom of religion and also, you know, non-discrimination on a religious basis. So it's
yeah.
It just seems so counter to everything I thought we had in Canada. I was just wondering, too, so since the detention, what contact were you allowed to have with WAFA?
Well, I was able to visit her for the initial period that she was in detention. I was still able to visit her, but I couldn't actually deliver belongings to her. And so my wife, who, you know, I don't want to get into the, you know, the nitty-gritty details, but I think it is worth mentioning because people should know this type of thing as it pertains to cases like my wife's. She wasn't even allowed to bathe or have access to basic toiletries or washroom facilities for days when she was initially processed and detained at the Rexdale Center. And she wasn't even allowed a change of underwear or underclothes or any kind of garments for well over a month after she was initially detained. And we found that surprising because many others were. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were other people who were also detained in what we imagined to be the same situation as my wife's, who were allowed that kind of access and you know, their spouses or friends or whatever were allowed to deliver those things to them. But for whatever reason, in my wife's case, that wasn't allowed initially. But then eventually they did allow us to deliver those things. As our case attracted more and more public attention, the situation there became a little bit more relaxed. However, I wasn't allowed direct physical contact with her. I would be speaking with her on the phone through a glass plate, a glass window, and at times people would interrupt the conversation and tell us that's enough time and just simply disconnect the call.
Oh, well.
I would call her, and I couldn't call her directly. I would call and leave a message. Sometimes that would be delivered. More often than not, it would, and my wife would get back to me. But again, oftentimes people would interrupt the telephone conversation and cut the call off. Of course, we were speaking in Arabic in the course of these conversations, and on more than one occasion, we could actually hear somebody on a third line translating word by word what we were saying to each other. Somebody who was obviously an Arabic speaker translating from Arabic to English for someone else.
Mm.
So, again, disturbing. But anyway, in the end, you know, I took my son out there, and it was his birthday. The very same day my wife was finally deported, that was his birthday. And so we took him out there hoping that my wife would be able to say goodbye. And he went there. He stood there. He was such a trooper in the protest that we had on that final day on the 27th. And my wife asked, and we asked the guards if she could give him a hug and say goodbye, and they refused. And again, I don't want to get this guard in trouble, but the guard who was working there was very, very sympathetic and made it very clear that he felt that this was from Mr. Kenny directly. And he also made some other comments, which I probably shouldn't repeat. At least not in a public forum like this one anyway. And as I say, I don't want to get him in trouble because he was actually a very nice and cooperative guard. But it was clear that a lot of the guards who were working there weren't comfortable with the situation that my wife was in. And I mean, what can I say? It was heart-wrenching to see my son not have that final access to her. But we tried, and he went out there, and at the very least, he was able to see so many people from so many walks of life who rallied together in support of my wife. And this is a woman that has always moved me and has always touched my heart, but I had no idea that in the brief period of time she had spent here in Hamilton that she had touched the hearts of so many other people. And this is the thing that I found mind-boggling. So many people who had not been involved in any kind of activism or political activity. They had never engaged in anything like this before, literally stepped up and rallied in support of my wife. They got directly involved with my wife's case and her cause, contributing to the website, which is still up and running. And, of course, we had a big fundraiser as well on the 25th of March, which went very well. That was at St. Paul's Anglican Church in Westdale. And I was floored when I saw the turnout there, because I literally expected there to be half of the number of people who showed up. And, you know, we're trying to raise awareness, but at the same time, it was a fundraiser to try to get the legal fees necessary to begin the process of getting my wife back to Canada. And, you know, thankfully, thanks to the people who came out and contributed, we're about halfway there. We still have a ways to go, but we're confident that we'll meet the goal. And, you know, very happy, very, very happy to see so many people from my hometown who went out of their way to take notice and to express their views on this issue.
Yeah, that's really great. It says a lot about the good people of Hamilton, as distinct from the officialdom world.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. So, Ian, just we only got a few minutes left. So, quickly, where is Wafa now, and how is she doing?
She's back in Egypt, and. And, well, she's doing as well as can be expected. She's holding up fairly well on a personal level. She feels unsafe because the situation there is unsafe. It's very unstable, particularly where she's living, which is a rural community. And there are some other details which I don't feel comfortable discussing in public. But, I mean, we're very concerned. We're very, very concerned. And we're not going to pretend that the situation there is by any means stable or safe or secure, because it's not. And this is something that our government knew full well, even before they decided that my wife ran no risk of being sent back there, because at the same time that they claimed that there was no risk to my wife being sent back there, they were also posting on the official Canada Foreign Affairs website warning Canadians about traveling there because of the possibilities of random violence, of abductions, of flash protests, of kidnappings, this, that, and the other thing. So I guess there's a different standard for Canadian citizens than there is for sending people back there.
Yeah, very, very inconsistent. And
very inconsistent. Yeah. Well, there were people who were detained with my wife for brief periods who had escaped the war in Syria directly. And I mean, Syria is a country where there is very clearly an open conflict taking place at the present time. But these Syrians would arrive at Pearson. They would be taken for a couple of days to where my wife was being detained and then deported back to a war zone.
Oh, my.
So, yeah. So it's not surprising that they would want to send my wife back to an unstable situation. But we are concerned for her there. And as I say, there are some details that we're aware of that make us even more concerned, which I don't want to discuss publicly at this time. But, you know, we're praying and we're hoping, and my wife is praying and hoping that she can be back with us as soon as possible. And our children are praying every night, and please pray for them and pray for her that she'll be back with her family where she belongs.
And we're certainly with you, Ian, in these prayers. And
we encourage our
listeners to help out if they can. And you have a website, or there is a website.
Facebook page, Reunite the Wilkie Family. And if you typed Wilkie Family, if you Googled it, you know, you would get a lot of newspaper articles, a lot of interviews that have been conducted. But by all means, go to the Facebook page, type in Wilkie Family. You can access the site that way. That's probably the fastest way. And find out more information if you're interested. And we'd certainly love to hear your thoughts. And, you know, we've had a lot of people calling in who have been baffled. And we welcome those types of calls. We welcome those types of emails as well. And, you know, we'll try to respond and get back to you. And
okay. And
Okay.
We're pretty well out of time. Ian, thanks so much for your time and giving us all the facts around your case and WAFA's case. And it is something we're going to continue to monitor. So maybe at some future date we can talk again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye, Doug.
Bye.